So good evening once again. How is everybody? Okay. Maybe we'll get some rain in the middle of this. Any questions from what we covered last time? This is, yes, Janice.
In the chart, you're talking about the grounds in the past.
Right.
I thought when you became an Arya being, when you entered the path of seeing, that was the moment before, that was the last moment of the mind of the sentient being. Like you said, it was just before attaining the ground of no more world.
Okay. What we usually distinguish prior to the path of seeing, we call them ordinary beings. So we would say that's an ordinary sentient being, whereas from the path of seeing up through the 10th, last moment of the 10th ground is what we would call an Arya sentient being. After that, it becomes an Arya Buddha. Okay. So it's no longer a sentient being. Again, not to say that a Buddha isn't a being or a Buddha isn't a person. A Buddha is not somebody who's within cyclic existence and bound by it and bound by the appearances, false appearances within cyclic existence and so on. So so basically that's why there's that delineation. But yeah, we would call it ordinary beings or ordinary bodhisattvas prior to path of seeing.
I guess when you become a bodhisattva, you're helping all sentient beings, and that goes up until
exactly
before you become a Buddha,
right. I mean, so we can even pray for, you know, make prayers for a tenth ground bodhisattva, you know, because they're even still at some measure, like, although again they're liberated from cyclic existence, they're still together with some level of obscuration. And so as long as you're with some level of obscuration, you're a sentient being. So, yeah. I mean, you're at a pretty high level of realization. But any other questions? Did everyone, I don't know if everyone was here last time for that chart. Did everyone get that chart? Okay. Or have it from your other materials? It was, I think it's in the materials I gave you, June. Yeah. Yeah. I won't refer to it a whole lot more tonight. I'll probably look at it again or bring it up again at some time in the future. But okay. So last time we, I think, pretty much discussed all of verse 2. There was a little bit that I kind of skipped over in terms of when we look at the commentary that you have. It's going to be the quote that's towards the top of page 220. Again, could somebody maybe share with June? June is, I didn't bring an extra copy. So, so at the top of page 220, which is, there's a quote there from Chandrakirti's Supplement to the Middle Way. I just want to give really a brief idea of what's being said there in case that verse was confusing for anyone. So this verse says from the sixth chapter, by the way, this text, the Supplement to the Middle Way, quite an amazing text to study, but it's divided into 10 chapters, primarily 10 chapters, that are each related to one of these 10 grounds that are on your chart. So in the sixth ground is when the bodhisattva achieves the surpassing practice of the perfection of wisdom. So the sixth chapter is the bulk of the entire text, and it's something like 200 and some odd verses. It's really, really amazing stuff and goes through a lot of different reasonings and things similar to what we're going to do in chapter 9. But that's just to give a context for where this verse is found. And he says here, whatever wrong entity of falling hair and the like is conceptualized through the force of cataracts, the real nature in which it is seen by correct eyesight is reality. Likewise, it should be known here. So this is the idea, and I'm not that familiar with cataracts. We actually had an eye doctor who was attending the master's program when we were studying this, and he said that, yeah, this is true, that when you do have cataracts in the eye, that it causes what would seem to be the appearance of falling hairs. It's various, you know, like black lines that you would see that are a part of your vision normally, you know, that everywhere that you look, you're seeing these sort of falling hairs. Well, to someone who, that's their only reality, that they're only seeing these falling hairs, someone who has perfect vision can point out to them, can reveal to them that what they are seeing is not the reality of what exists in the world at large. These hairs are simply a product of the condition of cataracts in the same way that the appearance of inherent existence and the adherence to that is a product of our ignorance. So in the same way that the illness of cataracts causes this mistaken appearance, so therefore does the ignorance that we are all under, the ignorance holding things to inherently exist, which in turn causes the appearance of inherent existence. All of this is how we should understand reality as well. Once we break through that ignorance and reveal things to exist in the way that they actually do, then we understand that falling hairs are false. We'll still have the appearance of falling hairs as long as we still are, dealing with what is needed to get rid of them, just in the same way that we still have the appearance of inherent existence all the way up to that last moment of a sentient being prior to, entering into Buddhahood. So that's the idea behind that verse. I don't know that we really explained it last time, but... any questions on that or on what we covered? So again, verse 2 was really kind of delineating these two truths. And we went through a little bit of the handout in regard to that. I'll wait and go through the last part of the handout when we get to another, a little bit later. One thing that I'm going to let you know about this commentary, oftentimes when we studied, they would have it structured so that you would have the verse that it's about immediately followed by the commentary, similar to what you've got in your book by His Holiness, so that the verses are pretty much matched with the commentary. Unfortunately, in what I gave you and what was used in the basic program over in Italy, they have all the verses at the front and then all the commentary, and you kind of have to match the verse with the commentary. So I'll let you know when we're going on to another verse so you can make your own notation in the margin about what that commentary, where it begins. So basically what we've done so far, of course, the first verse was pretty self-explanatory because it's only in its own section. 9.2, of course, begins at the bottom of page 219 and then goes to until where it says, with respect to the persons. At that paragraph that starts with respect to the persons who wish to determine the true truths, that's related to verse 3, 9.3. So let's go ahead and read verse 9.3 together, and then we can talk about it some. With respect to them, the supports of the transitory are seen to be of two types, yogis and common people. Among them, common supports of the transitory are damaged by yogi supports of the transitory. So there's all this talk about supports of the transitory. What do you think is a support of the transitory?
Support is an argument?
No, support is like something that is either, in this case, I think we could say it's supported on the transitory. No.
Just objects that we posit.
No, these are all good guesses. Let's go through this first bit of the commentary and see if we can, because it does give the answer there, sort of, but with respect to the persons who wish to determine the two truths, the supports of the transitory are persons imputed independence on the aggregates and are seen to be of two types. So whenever we say the supports of the transitory, we're basically talking about persons. And don't ask me, again, it's emphasizing the fact that in this school, a person is supported on the transitory, the impermanent aggregates. So we've talked about the aggregates at length, the mental and physical aggregates. They're sometimes classified as five aggregates, one physical and four mental. On the basis of that, which is the transitory, the person is supported on that. So it's a little strange to me, though, to say the support of the transitory, because I think it's almost the transitory is the support of the person. So it's almost like the supported of the transitory. But anyway, I didn't do the translation of this, so whoever did a wonderful job, but I think that there's some of these terms that are kind of hard to get into English. And so, that's what we're talking about here. So this is, again, seen to be two types of people then. So in regard to the people who know the two truths, directly, we should say, really, and we're really getting down to that distinction, there are two people. There's one, yogis possessing the meditative stabilization, that's a union of calm abiding and special insight, who realize all phenomena to be empty of inherent existence. So we're talking about somebody who's developed this very deep meditative union of an analytical, highly analytical mind with a very stable mind, who's directly realizing emptiness. So this is how that truth is known, is by a yogi. This is through what we called before in our tenet courses, and we'll see this again in Lohrig, a yogic direct perceiver. So this yogic direct perceiver that knows selflessness, that knows emptiness, is the person who has that, who is realizing that, because we can talk about the person being the realizer as well, the subject as well. That's the first type of person, and that defines which of the two truths then. Ultimate truth, okay. So then in regard to conventional, it's the second type of person, common people who are propounders of truly existent things. So this categorization is in terms of the main groups, even persons who have realized emptiness by way of hearing and contemplation, and those who have not transformed their minds with tenets should be included in these categories too. So it's interesting, my teacher in his commentary said that he included those two groups that he mentions at the end, in some in the first and some in the second, you know, the first group in the first and the second group in the second, but I've read other commentaries that actually say that both of these would be put into the second. Even though we have some understanding of emptiness, can we be a true knower of that object of emptiness? And this is what we meant in the previous verse when we said that it is not an object of mind, meaning it's not an object of this mind with dualistic appearance, this mind that isn't knowing things directly. So we can basically, you know, say that as far as I can see, both of these people would still be included within the second category. So even though we have some understanding of emptiness, we still are going to be only valid with regard to conventional truths, because we really haven't gotten the direct valid cognizer that knows emptiness. Might have an inferential valid cognition of it, which again does say that it's getting to the object, but because it's not really free of that conceptual medium, that generic image that is with conceptuality, we really can't say that it knows that phenomenon, you know, in a direct way. So again, I might be pushing it too far in that. My teacher, again, was quite clear in saying that those who know emptiness by way of hearing and contemplation, which would still be conceptual, would also fit into that first category. Maybe you have arguments both ways. You know, again, I don't want to go belabor this point, but so then let's go on to the next paragraph. This is still within verse 3. Actually, we're going to be on verse 3 for a little while. Common supports of the transitory, who assert partless particles, partless instants of consciousness, and the true existence of mere things, are yogis, but are also supports of the transitory. Hence, the person who is a yogi support of the transitory, realizing the lack of inherent existence, damages the propounders of truly existent things of a lower tenet system. Even higher yogis possessing a union of calm abiding and special insight damage the successively lower ones. So this was a point that we made when we studied the various tenet systems. And that what you find is that certainly you could go through the tenet systems and begin to hold the view of that particular philosophical system. As you move through, though, you find that eventually what you learn and what you uncover in the tenets of that next system end up overcoming, confuting is a word that I saw in one translation, but you know, the idea is that they directly negate what we would have realized at a lower level. So all of the teachings of all these various systems that support and propound true existence, inherent existence, are eventually all completely overcome by the highest point of view, the view of the Prasangika Madhyamika, which is what, you know, Shantideva is clearly setting out in this text. So this idea is, again, part of that verse that we just saw in verse 3, where it says, among them, common supports of the transitory are damaged by yogi supports of the transitory. So we see that the common beliefs that are held, the ordinary beliefs that are held, are always refuted by someone who, you know, can discern reality more clearly. And certainly someone who has a yogic direct perceiver of the nature of things is going to directly refute anything that's held, you know, on a more conventional level. So for example, let's not get into selfishness or emptiness at this point. But we've talked in the past, and we're going to mention it again a little bit later, about yogic direct perceivers perceiving impermanence. So it's not that yogic direct perceivers are only seeing selflessness, they're also seeing a conventional truth. So in that way, the mind of a yogi refutes the ordinary mind that holds that things have some permanent existence. So we don't recognize, we might recognize gross impermanence, you know, that things go out of existence in a very not so subtle way. When we die and so on, these are gross impermanence. But we don't get subtle impermanence, that things are changing moment by moment. With a yogic direct perception, union of calm abiding and special insight, seeing the impermanence of all conditioned phenomena, that refutes the ordinary understanding that things have a permanent nature, that all these produced things, conditioned things, have some lasting, unchanging nature. So then, as it says in the next paragraph, kind of continuing and reinforcing that, the middle way proponents, Madhyamikas, refute through reasoning the mind-only proponents, who assert that the consciousness is truly existent. They, the mind-only proponents, in turn, refute through reasoning the sutra school proponents, Sautrantikas, who accept partless particles. I didn't get a chance to go back and check. I mean, in our tenet studies, we didn't really see that partless particles were a part of the tenets of Sautrantika. They were presented under Vaibhashika, but I do believe that there's the one branch of Sautrantika that holds pretty much to the same tenets, because they were the ones following sutra, I believe. There's following sutra and following reasoning, and they're pretty much following the Abhidharmakosha. So the Abhidharmakosha teaches partless particles, so I would assume that that branch of Sautrantika is who they're referring to here, that adhere to partless particles. I think that the other one doesn't, but again, I could be wrong on that. But that's just to make some clarification on what's being presented. Right, yeah. It's the followers of sutra, I think, yeah. I'm pretty sure that was the one that said that they were... So then it goes on to... Well, actually, this is kind of leading up to verse 4. I don't know that we're quite at 4 yet. Somebody raises a qualm here, as you can see from your commentary. It says, among the yogis who realize emptiness, do they not damage each other? And the response is, even among the yogis who realize emptiness, due to differences in their mind, those abiding on the higher grounds, such as the second ground, damage, that is, outshine those abiding on the lower, such as the first ground. So again, if you refer back to that chart I gave you, you see that I mentioned last time that there are these realizations of emptiness that help to progress. The Bodhisattva progresses through the various grounds, along with the accumulation of merit. So we definitely say that the wisdom that the Bodhisattva has as they progress through those grounds grows. Their wisdom is, you know, outshining those of inferior grounds. Not that, again, those aren't outshining those below them. Everything is respectively growing, progressively more powerful. Your wisdom is getting deeper because of your direct realization of emptiness that you're cultivating over the path, and the obstacles, the obscurations that you're removing along with that. So your mind is becoming clearer and clearer and less obscured along with the deepness, the depth of your realization of emptiness. So it says, you should understand through inference that in terms of a single continuum, so this is in terms of one person's mental continuum, due to differences in the enhancement of the mind, for example, that unable to damage, differences in the enhancement of the mind, for example, that, looks like there's some a verb missing here or something. I'm not, yeah.
Subject that's something unable to damage.
You should understand through inference that in terms of physical, do a difference in the enhancement of the mind, for example, that is, I don't know. I read this before and it was fine, but now I look at it and there's no subject or something
right,
missing.
There's subject missing.
I mean, the idea here, I believe, is that, again, we can say that, you know, as the mind becomes more and more powerful through the force of these direct realizations of emptiness, that obscurations that you couldn't abandon on a lower ground can be damaged on a higher ground. I mean, this is kind of spelling out the force of our realization of emptiness kind of outshining that on a lower ground. So on the very first direct realization of emptiness, this occurs when, again? Path of seeing. So on the path of seeing, and what is this a direct antidote to? But which level of those? We talked last time about there being kind of two levels of those. There's the acquired and the innate, okay? So your first initial direct realization of emptiness only has the power to remove the acquired. You can't even touch the innate with that initial direct realization of emptiness. So the idea that is being said here is that you'll find that as the mind becomes progressively stronger through the progression, as this single continuum of mind goes through the grounds, it's able to remove things that were unable to be removed at a lower level. So this is kind of showing that this outshining or being able to damage, you know, lower levels is going on even in the case of a single continuum. So the purpose of composing these passages is as follows. Having ascertained minds to be of two types, minds that realize the conventional and minds that realize the ultimate. If even a valid cognizer realizing the conventional does not damage a mind realizing the ultimate, then what need to mention about it being damaged by adherence of partless particles? So if we already said that, you know, in the end, this mind of that only realizes the conventional is outshined, shown completely by the mind that realizes the ultimate emptiness, then what need is there to say that all these other tenet systems that adhere to various other things aren't outshone as well by that mind that realizes the ultimate? So again, this is with some sense of the superior view of the Prasangika that we can make this assertion. So this is for the sake of making it known that the mind realizing the ultimate damages all that hold to extremes. So in the end, this wisdom realizing emptiness cuts through everything. There's nothing, it's like your final trump card, you know. It will cut through everything else. Nothing beats it. Nothing is superior to it. Okay, this next section actually then is what I related to the second, the last bit of this section, which was verse 4, the first two lines, A and B. So why don't we read that now? Even yogis, due to differences in their minds, are damaged by the successively higher. So although we've already seen this idea, it's really spelled out quite clearly in this paragraph. It says, furthermore, even among yogis, due to differences in minds, one, the reasonings of the great exposition proponents, the Vaibhashikas, the sutra school proponents, and so forth, damage the assertions of permanence and truly existent things made by the outsiders. The outsiders are the non-Buddhists. So again, when we did our tenet study, we began with looking at some of these non-Buddhists who have various views, like the Samkhya's view of, you know, this fundamental nature or whatever they called it, the other points of view that were around at the time that all Buddhist systems, particularly those at the very lowest level, refute, because they refute that there's an existence of a permanent, unitary, independent self. And that is an assertion that's made by non-Buddhist schools. Then in the next bullet point, the reasonings of the mind only, we're stepping up into the Mahayana tenets, my only proponents and so forth damage the assertions of partless particles made by the two propounders of truly existent objects, that is, Vaibhashika and Satrantika. So we see that again, with regard to, you know, whether we're talking about ultimate truths or conventional truths, there's always this ability, due to the perception that yogis have and each of the higher levels of tenet systems, to completely refute, or not completely, to refute some of the fallacious proponent or tenets that are held by proponents who are beneath them. The reasonings of the middle way, the Madhyamika proponents, damage the assertions of the consciousness being truly established, which is made by the mind-only proponents. So recall that with mind-only, they were saying there's no truly existent things, or no existent, you know, external phenomena, because all phenomena are arising from the same seed that the consciousness knowing that phenomena arises. So in this way, they were refuting external existence, but they were adhering to a truly existent consciousness, this mind that is knowing that object and so on. And he said, and then he just says, and so forth. So you should understand that the counterfeit meanings in the thesis of the lower tenet systems are damaged by the reasonings of the successively higher tenet systems. The above explanation is the assertion of the great commentary. That finishes this first section. So this was just, again, our introduction to the two truths. Let's go ahead and take a look at the handout, because I wanted to go ahead and cover that one last little bit. This was, again, what I handed out last time, handout number 2. Everyone has it there? The second side. I don't know, first of all, did anyone take a look at these arguments as to what would happen if we held that the two truths were one entity, and if we held, or I mean, were you know, different entities, and if they were one isolate? So there's these, again, 4 arguments. Do we want to revisit it? No. Again, know that there's information in Jeffrey Hopkins' Meditation on Emptiness on this. There's also, again, from the Two Truths, the passage that's here. But there's lots of resources you can go to get a little bit better flavor of those. What I'd like to go through now is this little bit at the bottom, number C, or item C, regarding the meaning of non-dual. This is from Meditation on Emptiness. Actually, I forgot to put the page number there. I can tell you in a second, I think. Let's go ahead and actually, I don't know where it is. I'll find it for you and give it to you next time. Okay. It says the Janangba. The Janangba is, again, where this group of Tibetans who were asserting what's called other emptiness. I touched on this really briefly last time. The idea is that in Prasangika and in the teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa, it's held to be self-emptiness, meaning an object itself is empty of inherent existence, that we're relating it directly to the object. That's why we made all these assertions about it needing to be, you know, different entities or different isolates and yet one entity. So it's the same, on the same basis that we're talking about two different isolates, its emptiness and its conventional existence. So again, this is how what we mean when we talk about self-emptiness. The Janangpas were asserting that we were saying, talking about an object, but referring to something that is other than the object in regard to emptiness. It's a very hard concept to get your head around, but yes. Shentong and Daktong, I think, is the other one, is self-emptiness. I think it's Daktong. Shentong is other emptiness, yeah. There's a huge, huge book that Jeffrey Hopkins has published called Mountain Doctrine. It goes into like a whole exposition of other emptiness and the Janangpa point of view. So the Janangpa assertion of a difference of entity between the two truths contradicts the sutra unraveling the thought. But it does reflect the Gelugpa acceptance that at the time of direct cognition of emptiness, by anyone except a Buddha, that is, none of the conventional phenomena which are the basis of the quality emptiness appear to the mind. A direct cognition of emptiness is non-dual in four ways. So we're talking about the quality of that mind that is directly realizing emptiness, it lacking dualistic appearance. It lacks that in four ways. One, all appearances of inherent existence have ceased. So normally, as I said, in all of our ordinary day-to-day consciousness until we get to Buddhahood, we're together with some false appearance of things appearing to inherently exist. This is what we call these obscurations to omniscience. Part of our obscurations to omniscience is that dualistic appearance that's always going on, the appearance of things having inherent existence. So that's one way of talking about dualistic existence. I don't know if it's raining in. Two, all appearance of conventionalities have ceased. So we no longer have any conventionalities appearing. This is why the Jnanpas say that it's an other emptiness, because you're no longer with the object that you were focused on, because you're focused, for example, if I want to realize the emptiness of this mala, I take this mala as the basis, and I'm analyzing it, trying to find an inherently existent mala. When I cease to find that, if I'm a yogi that's capable of doing this, the mala falls away. I'm no longer seeing any conventionalities. All I'm seeing is its emptiness. I'm knowing the phenomena, which is the emptiness of mala, with no mala as a referent being there. This is why the Jnanpas say this is an other emptiness, because it's not together with the mala any longer. It was never with the mala. In essence, they're saying they're different entities, as it's, you know, Jeffrey Hopkins is saying. It's primarily, as I understand it, based on the second one, that there's no appearance of conventionalities. Thirdly, all appearances of subject and object have ceased. So this is what I've talked about before. It's like water poured into water. The mind knowing emptiness and emptiness, there's no differentiation of subject and object. It's, you know, the perfect mind meld, you know, with emptiness. It's totally indistinguishable. Fourthly, all appearances of generic images or conceptual meaning generalities have ceased. So this is actually an interesting one, because a lot of them just say three types of dualistic appearance, but Jeffrey Hopkins throws in this fourth one. Again, it's just meaning it's non-conceptual. You no longer have a generic image of emptiness involved in it at all, which is a part of all these others as well. I mean, not all conventionalities are together with a generic image, because obviously we have to have our conceptual mind involved. But basically we can say that all, whenever we have subject and object, well, that's not necessarily true either. It's an interesting point. It does just kind of add another understanding of what is going on with this mind realizing emptiness, and how we could talk about it lacking dualistic appearance in regard to that. So that we've referred to this a couple of times. This will come up again later when we, you know, go into more depth about, you know, emptiness. But this is just to give you an understanding of what can be meant by dualistic appearance and the lack of dualistic appearance to the mind realizing emptiness directly. Okay? Let's move on. So, as I mentioned now, this is, you know, I put up on the board that overall outline of the text. So we're moving into, we already have kind of moved into the main body of the text, that is the presentation of the, or this part of the text that has the presentation of the two truths. We went into the actual presentation, and now we're going to dispel objections that there is no need and ability for emptiness, meaning no need to realize emptiness and no ability even to realize emptiness. You know, people who are going to take issue with this lack of inherent existence. So this is divided into an actual presentation in regard to that, and then dispelling damage with regards to that. So let's go ahead and read just the first two lines then in that section, 9.4 CD. By way of analogies that both assert, because one does not analyze for the sake of a result. So this is a very strange little like phrase. It's not even a complete sentence. We'll go to the commentary, which again, this first part is related to this verse, 9.4 CD, beginning there where it says, opinion. So this is an implicit opinion. Sometimes the opinions are spelled out in Shantideva's text. Sometimes the opinions or the, you know, objections are implied, meaning that Shantideva is like answering people before they've even communicated what they're going to communicate. So in this case, it's implied because this opinion is saying that the tenet systems of common beings are damaged by the reasoning of the yogis who realize that all phenomena are empty of inherent existence is untenable. So basically this person's saying, you know, you're full of it. You know, you really aren't refuting anything. Why? There's nothing to prove the lack of inherent existence. And in the absence of inherent existence, it will be meaningless to try to train in generosity and so forth for the sake of the result Buddhahood. So these are people who are basically, you know, adhering to the fact that if it doesn't inherently exist, it doesn't exist. We're going to see them again. I mean, this is basically what this section is about, is in terms of people beginning to take exception to this idea of things lacking inherent existence. So we can see certainly that even this is a challenge, we've talked about it in the past, as we go through our own understanding of emptiness. We've talked before about the two extremes, how we have to ride that razor's edge between falling from the one extreme, which is still adhering to things to have some inherent existence, not going far enough and negating this false way that they exist. But then there's the other extreme, which is saying that they don't inherently exist, therefore they don't exist, where we end up refuting the mere existence of things. This nihilistic approach to things is not beneficial either, and it's not the perfect middle way. So this is somebody who, right from the beginning, is saying, one, I don't even think that you're right in saying that things lack inherent existence, because as far as I'm concerned, you can't prove that they do lack inherent existence. And as far as I'm concerned, two, if they did lack inherent existence, then everything is meaningless. This is a nihilistic point of view. Training in generosity, the six perfections, and so on, to attain Buddhahood is pointless, because if things don't inherently exist, they don't exist. And we're going to see this again when we start using these ideas that things are like an illusion and so on. People making some jump to saying, well, if that's so, then there's all these other consequences that they see. But that's because they're not really understanding the middle way point of view. So the response from Shantideva is basically saying, as it says there, it follows that it is not that there is nothing to prove the lack of inherent existence. So he's saying, you know, you're wrong. You're totally wrong in saying that we can't prove that things lack inherent existence. Why? Because by means of analogies such as dreams and illusions that are renowned to both the middle way proponents and those who propound truly existent things are known as false. So all these analogies that we're going to use of things being like a dream, like an illusion, we all conventionally agree that a dream is false, right? Do you wake up from your dream and really believe that it happened? You sure you believe you dreamt, but you didn't believe what happened in the dream really happened. You also, you know, if there's an illusion or a mirage or other things that are often used, you don't hold them to actually be what they're appearing to be. So with a mirage, it appears to be water, but you know from experience that when you drive to the mirage, you never run into water. You know, eventually the mirage disappears or keeps going off in the distance. There's never water. So same thing, they use this illusory idea a lot because, again, this is a common one, this magician's illusion, things that are conjured up that appear to be something that they really aren't. Any questions so far? Okay. Feel free to interject if you do have questions. I'll ask occasionally too, but I'm happy to stop in the middle. Uh-huh. That's why we always use this dream-like and illusion-like. So this is going to be a point of contention in the next section when we get to where people are arguing with the Prasangika saying, you know, if they're an illusion, then there's all these other consequences, and it doesn't matter if I kill somebody, or doesn't all these other things, you know, just like in a dream, where you could say there's no killing of a being in a dream, then we would say there's no killing of a being in this illusory world that we live in. And that's going too far. Again, that's going to the point where you're falling into an extreme. So basically what he's trying to say here is that there is a way to prove it and to show it and to demonstrate it using analogies that we all kind of accept and understand that we can apply in a particular way to arrive at the same understanding of how things lack inherent existence. I mean, not that, again, it's kind of an interesting little dialogue because none of the real reasonings that we're going to get into later on in the text are like the reasoning of the illusion or the reasoning of the dream. These are more analogies that we use. There were, I don't know how many analogies that the Buddha used to talk about it. Sometimes some of them are like what we say in the beginning prayer, you know, an illusion, a drop of dew, a bubble, a flash of lightning, da-da-da-da. Some of these are more related to phenomena, conditioned phenomena and impermanence, but others can also be used to get to their lack of inherent existence. But there's things like an echo, you know, an echo is seen, heard to be a voice, but it lacks any real voice. It's not voice because it's only an echo, but an illusion, mirage,
a reflection
in a mirror.
Another reflection isn't a real object.
Yeah. So there's all these things that, you know, we're going to refer to here and there that Prasangika is simply pointing to these propounders of true existence, which are all the tenet systems below, and saying, you know, you all are, you can come along for the ride because we're going to use things that you can commonly understand, that you can share ground with, that you can relate to, if you will. We're not talking about creating a whole new way of looking at the world, that there's not some other analogies that we can relate to. So he said again that by means of analogies such as dreams and illusions, seeing them as false, and that both assert. So we both assert the existence of these. You know, a mirage exists, sure, but not existing as water. An illusion exists, but not as what it's conjured up to appear as. So again, like the stick that's made to look like an elephant or something. It doesn't exist as an elephant. We'll all, you know, use these things and agree on them. So the lack of inherent existence is established in dependence upon these types of analogies, is set out with these types of analogies. And then he goes on to say, you know, in your other point, so again, this implied opponent was saying two points. One, you can't even prove that inherent existence is lacking. Two, if it is lacking in the absence of inherent existence, everything else doesn't make sense. All these efforts on the path and practicing the perfections and so on don't make sense. So now he goes on to say, it follows that in the absence of inherent existence, it will not be meaningless to train in generosity and so forth. Why? Because although generosity and the like, for the sake of attaining a result such as Buddhahood, do lack true existence. You know, he'll say right up front, yeah, no problem. They lack inherent existence, true existence. One engages in them by way of being conjoined with the wisdom, realizing them as false and illusory, without investigation and without analysis. So what this is getting to, again, we've talked about this several times in the past when we were going through the other chapters of Shantideva. I generally tried at the end of each chapter when we were dealing with other perfections to talk about how it's advised to practice that perfection with the other perfections, particularly with the perfection of wisdom. So, for example, when we're engaged in generosity, we can see that we can engage in it simply on a conventional level of I am giving money to this person. Very simple. We can also engage in it in terms of a non-inherently existent I am giving non-inherently existent money to a non-inherently existent person, and then the whole act of giving is non-inherently existent. Often we refer to this as the three spheres, but you know, it's the object, the agent, and the subject, or the object, the agent, and the action. Sometimes there's also the object of the action, like the money itself that's giving, but we would say generally the giver is empty, the recipient is empty, and the act of giving is empty. All three of these lack inherent existence. This is what makes them perfections. You know, this is what conjoining them with this wisdom and with this bodhicitta motivation makes them into perfections. As it says here, for if the wisdom realizing the lack of inherent existence is not conjoined, then the remaining perfections do not obtain the name perfection, and they must travel to the city of omniscience together with a guide of the blind. We talked about this before, about how, like, you know, we're being, you know, this perfection of wisdom is the perfect vision that the blind perfections, the five other perfections, get to the land of enlightenment, you know, through that guide. So this was what we used, I think this was in our first class when we were talking about the lack, or the perfection of wisdom and what was entailed in the perfection of wisdom. So this is our perfect vision that gets us there. If we never conjoin our practice of the six perfections with the perfection of wisdom, they're impotent. They'll never get there. They'll never produce the result. Yes, Janice.
But I thought what makes a perfection a perfection is the intention of bodhicitta. So this is a little different.
But this is also saying that it'll never actually achieve the full state of perfection without the perfection of wisdom. It is true that, you know, we have said that, and we, you know, then we can also, you know, say it's ultimate and conventional bodhicitta. Recall that this word bodhicitta, we can refer to conventional bodhicitta, which is this mind that wants to become enlightened, but then we can also refer to ultimate bodhicitta, which is the bodhisattva's direct realization of emptiness. So in that sense, we could say that both, you know, need to, both the conventional mind and the ultimate mind need to be there to attain the result. And they aren't perfections without both. However, I mean, we can talk about somebody practicing the perfection of generosity prior to even having a direct realization of emptiness. So in that way, we could say that, yes, they can be called a perfection, but they're not really going to be, again, that's a case of calling it by the result, calling the cause by the result. And until you get to the result or begin to, you know, have that perfection of wisdom, it's hard to say that it is a perfection. Not quite yet. Let's go ahead. Any questions on that? That little couple lines? Yeah,
so
Paul?
If I realize that my work is empty while I'm doing it,
mm-hmm.
is that's perfection of work?
The perfection of work? you should be realizing all things to be empty of inherent existence while you're doing them. I mean, ideally, we should be bringing that wisdom into, you know, and again, both minds of bodhicitta have this perfect motivation of making all of our actions very purposeful and meaningful, and unite that with a realization that they're lacking inherent existence. I mean, does it make it a perfection of work? That's kind of a strange concept, but it makes it a perfection, trying to practice the perfection of wisdom in your work, sure. Yeah. Okay. Before we go on to the next verse, then, let's go ahead and take a little break. And when we come back, we'll go into verse 5 and continue through chapter 9. Yeah, so what I did is I put the name here. I realized that this isn't on, because that this is an excerpt from, like, pages 219 to whatever of this text, that you don't have the name of the person who wrote this. You will find his name on some of the other handouts from the other Shantideva courses, because I did occasionally quote from this text and give you some of that on handouts. But it's the Abbot Drukpa Gyaltsen. And so I don't really know a whole lot about him. Maybe next time I'll give you a little bit of commentary on him once I do a little bit of research, who he was. And usually, just so you know, usually when this text is taught in the basic program by a Tibetan teacher, they usually use Gyaltsep J's commentary on Shantideva. For whatever reason, Geshe Jampi Gyatso, my teacher over in Italy, when they were doing the basic program there after the master's program, he decided he wanted to use this text. I guess this is the one that he usually uses when he teaches Shantideva. So this is all the translation that was done This chapter 9, the root text was translated by Venerable Joan Nicell, who is the coordinator of the master's program, and then the commentary was translated by Ziggy To, who is a Singaporean student who was in the master's program with me. And so anyway, I just wanted to let you know who all these other sentient beings that were involved in getting that to you. So, Sarah, I imagine. I mean, probably, yeah, Sarah, but I don't know for sure. I'll confirm a little bio of him next time. Okay, let's read verse 5 together before going into the commentary on it. Mundane beings see things and conceive them to be real, not illusory. Therefore, here yogis and mundane beings debate. So there's also kind of an opinion that is being set out here, you know, by somebody. This is, again, a sort of implied opinion that's not stated in the text, as we see in the commentary. So your paragraph that starts on page, the bottom of 221, where it says opinion, for instance, so this is where we're starting with verse 5, fire that is able to perform the function of boiling, burning, and so forth is established by a direct perceiver. Everybody together with me on that? If you also accept this, then we are saying this is truly existent, whereby we have no object to debate about. However, if you do not accept this, then there will be much damage, such as contradiction by a direct perceiver. So what's going on here is basically we're dealing with somebody again who's seeing that if things lack inherent existence, they lack their own identity. So again, the general definition that's given for fire is that which is hot and burning. So if we say that which is hot and burning are the inherent characteristics of fire, this is why we identify it as fire, and we all have this to some degree in our consciousness. This is our ignorance that mistakenly thinks that things exist by way of their own characteristics. It's due to these characteristics existing independent of the mind knowing them, independent of causes and conditions, independent of parts and so on, that establishes their existence. And if we deny their inherent existence, we deny their existence. We can't talk about things that are fire, that which is hot and burning, because we've denied their inherent existence. It's equating existence and inherent existence. When you deny one, you deny the other. When you assert one, you assert the other. So this is the opinion that Shantideva is addressing, and he says in his response, these are debates of those who hold the two truths as contradictory, thinking that if things lack inherent existence, then they will be utterly non-existent. And if they exist, then they must exist inherently. So if you equate the two of those and you think that then to deny one is contradictory to the other existing, if you deny non-inherent existence, then how can you assert existence? Because inherent existence and existence to them mean exactly the same thing. So the two truths then are contradictory. To say that something exists conventionally and ultimately it lacks inherent existence, they don't work in the minds of these opponents. They don't work in our minds. I mean, this is what we're struggling with constantly, is to try to find a way to hold to conventional existence while we're refuting inherent existence. Again, that's the challenge we have of that middle way between the two extremes, is finding that perfect view that allows us to do that, to ride the razor's edge between those two extremes. Starting from where? to actually be able to hold to some conventional existence, and again, we'll get to what we've talked about that before, but merely through imputation that things exist, being able to still assert their functionality, their ability to exist, their ability to give rise to their results, all these things, and still refute that they inherently exist, refute that there is intrinsic existence from the object's own side. Okay. So then we continue with the commentary. It says, although the mundane middle way proponents and the mundane propounders of truly existent things, so by mundane here we're kind of meaning, you know, those who are simply dealing with mundane matters. We're not talking about, you know, them being mundane, but that they're only looking at conventional things. Just, we're talking about this conventional valid cognizer. Recall that when we define the two truths, a conventional truth was defined in terms of it being identified as a conventionality by the conventional, an analyzer of conventionalities. We're talking about our direct valid cognizer that, or our valid cognizer, let's just say, not direct, our valid cognizer that is out to discern what are conventionalities. So, although both of those, the mundane middle way proponents and the mundane propounders of truly existent things, both see with valid cognition things such as fire and accept them. So we accept the existence of fire. You know, a Madhyamaka is not going to debate with them on that. The propounders of truly existent things conceive and accept them to be established as real. So we're taking the same basis, you know, of fire. So here's fire. Madhyamakas say fire exists because conventionally we can label it as fire. It's got the basis of imputation for fire and so on. Others also say that there's fire. We all not having our debate there. The debate arises because they, the propounders of truly existent things, hold that fire to inherently exist. They conceive of it as such, and they adhere to that conception. Madhyamikas, on the other hand, refute the inherent existence of the fire. They say that there is no inherently existent fire. So in terms of conventional analysis, whatever we want to call conventional analysis, yeah, where's the fire? Oh, it's over there. You know, see the flames? We'll all point to the same thing. What is ultimate? When we do our ultimate analysis of the nature of fire, we find that there is nothing that inherently exists as fire. Whereas the proponents of true existence say that if you refuted that, you're refuting the existence of fire. Okay? So they conceive and accept them to be established as real, but do not understand them to be empty of true existence and illusory. Illusory in what way? They appear to inherently exist, but they aren't. This is the problem. It's like if they didn't appear to inherently exist, then we probably wouldn't buy into it so much. You know, the conception is one thing. The appearance of them as inherently existent seems to validate our conception of them as inherently existent. So we have to understand they don't exist that way, and how they are appearing is illusory. There's something that's appearing to be inherently existent that is in direct contradiction with how it actually exists. It's like a dream object. Again, that's why we use these things, like a dream, like an illusion. In our dream, our objects in a dream appear to be very real, right? I mean, when you're in a dream, they're as real as the objects that we're dealing with in this life. But when we wake, they're lacking that reality. They appeared in one way and existed in another. That's why dream analogy is used. That's why the illusion analogy is used, because they are illusory. Were you going to blow a gasket or something?
Yeah, she's hissing. I'm playing a bubble.
One bubble.
But like, you know, the dream, you can sometimes it's so funny.
Right.
And then you even change the outcome of the dream. You just don't buy into it. But here, I can do that actually sometimes in a dream, and I haven't found a way to make that happen here.
But I think you're taking the analogy too far in that case, then. The analogy of a dream works when we deal with the dream as a dream state that we buy into as real.
Right.
It doesn't work when it becomes a dream state that we don't buy into as real in that regard. I mean, again,
I mean, it's so challenging because here the habits are so strong that even mm-hmm. though intellectually you might be trying to say, like, you know, keep it together, think about emptiness, you know, you can do it.
Right.
But your habit is so strong that when you get something you don't like, that's like a really good example, the habit of how you react is so heavy, so strong.
Yeah. Again, that's why it just takes. It just takes, you know, the continual effort to eventually, you know, trim the afflictions down, and also eventually uproot the ignorance that's behind the whole thing. You know, and we can get it, even getting it at a conceptual level. It's pretty profound. I mean, Aryadeva in his 400 stanzas says, even just the idea of emptiness can shake the foundations of the earth.
Yeah. Not just mice.
Right.
Like, oh.
But, you know, or they actually say, yeah, sort of shake the foundation of cyclic existence. You know, what we're really talking about is you plant incredible seeds to eventually uproot the whole thing simply by conceptually realizing emptiness, having an understanding of emptiness that begins the process of unraveling the whole thing. Yeah, I mean, but it can happen prior to that even. I mean, yeah.
I think words somehow, when we keep the words and we go table, and then we try to talk ourselves out of it being a table, we're using words and we're using more concepts behind the words. Mm-hmm. And I think language sometimes keeps us still struggling with something there.
Right.
But you have to start somewhere.
But even to be able to recognize that things are merely labeled is a good step in the right direction. You know, this is part of, again, why dependent arising is said to be the king of reasonings, because it allows us to actually get to emptiness and hold on to the way things conventionally exist. So the naming certainly it can be a force of creating more adherence to inherent existence, but we can also recognize when it's mere naming, mere labeling. So there's nothing that, you know, makes this mala from its own side. Yeah, there are, you know, beads, and there's, you know, all the other things that we're identifying, but we can even begin to pick that apart. You keep going through, it's like those, you know, I've used this analogy before, those nesting, make them in Russia, like the Russian dolls, nesting dolls. You pull one away, and then that one pulls apart, and that one pulls apart. Now, you know, this is the same process. It's like you begin to see that there's no inherently existent mala, and then, but what about the parts of the mala? Well, there's no inherently existent bead, and then you go, what about the parts of the bead? And, you know, everything falls away. You never find anything that is a real inherent essence to anything.
But by the nature that you keep dissecting and making bits of pieces, actually refuting that in some ways, because I understand it. The whole fact that it's being supported by all these other bits and pieces, and you're actually going in more into its existence by refuting it.
I guess it's possible. But you're going in a way that the way that it exists is very slight. Ultimately, that's where you should find yourself in, is a place where you recognize that things, what's holding it together at some level, it's very, very slight.
But is there a way you can just gaze upon and not see table, the word, you know? But we all understand the whole concept of breaking things down into where's the essence of something.
Right.
But at some point, I think sometimes our language and words.
Yeah. I see what you're saying.
Even practice or meditation.
Well, when you see that the conceptual thought is a different phenomenon from what we think is the conceptual thought. So again, I keep, you know, holding this up and wanting to say mala, but, you know, mala in the end is a label put on this, which is the basis of designation for mala. They're two different phenomena. So, I mean, there is some value to isolating that conception that is mala, and this, which is the basis of designation of mala. But again, each time we go after another part of it, we see the same process. Because in the bead, there is only a label of bead on this basis forbid. You know, it just keeps slipping away from you. So there's definitely a benefit to isolating that concept of mala from what we believe mala is, because that is getting at this mistaken conception that we have, that we hold things to be that from their own side.
Sure, but you don't want to reach the point where you just stay in a sort of non-conceptual state.
Right.
I mean, it's okay to have the conceptual reality.
Maybe if you're Zen, you want to stay in a non-conceptual state. I don't know. We've talked about this before. I think there's different approaches to kind of getting a realization of emptiness. And in this school, definitely what we're trying to do is use the conventional, value the conventional, and all of our knowledge of it to support our understanding of emptiness, not kind of go into some non-conceptual state where that's not, in this school, believed to be the answer to, you know, realizing emptiness. Okay, let's finish this. It says, on the other hand, the middle way proponents understand this, meaning they understand that things are empty of true existence and illusory. The fire doesn't, you know, inherently exist or truly exist. Therefore, here, meaning in this area, the middle way yogis and the mundane proponents of, or propounders of true existence, debate. So it's like we don't debate with you on, you know, these regular conventionally existent things that we all can agree on. Yeah, there's fire, there's mala, there's book. What we agree, or what we debate with you on, is how does it actually exist? If we analyze, is there any ultimate existence? Ultimate existence meaning equating to true existence, inherent existence. And in that way, you know, there is room for debate, certainly. Alternatively, apply the former mundane beings in 9.5a only to the propounders of truly existent things and not to the middle way proponents. This is just kind of giving a footnote about how you could look at some of the text, that verse, and actually apply it, the meaning a little bit different in terms of who are the mundane ones. Because you notice that we did put, you know, that mundane middle way proponents and so on. And I explain that as kind of like referring only to, you know, our mundane knowledge, our worldly knowledge. The Buddha himself said, you know, I didn't come to, you know, argue with the world about what the world accepts. I came to show the world, you know, the reality of how things exist. So, but we are going to get into this area of like what then decides what conventionally exists. Because, for example, I was already talking to you about how a yogic direct perceiver realizing impermanence, subtle impermanence, is refuting what we normally hold, which is that things have some permanent, unchanging nature. If we kind of analyze and we listen to what the reasonings are that show that there must be subtle impermanence, we can begin to understand it. But because conventionally the world agrees that things do have some lasting nature, does that mean that they do? Worldly convention, just for the world to say it, doesn't mean that that is how it actually exists. But at the same time, we will generally say that what the world asserts to exist, yeah, the Buddha doesn't really have a problem with that. The Buddha has a problem with the mistaken conceptions of how things exist. Okay. Let's go on. Now we're entering into this rather large section, which is called Dispelling Damage with regards to that explanation that we just went through. So what we just talked about in terms of how, you know, this is asserted and how things lack inherent existence and yet still exist and so on. We're going to go into a first section, which is this general refutation of the propounders of truly existent things. So this is like very general. This is kind of, you know, getting at, once we've made this assertion, what are the points that people could raise that adhere to this inherent existence in things, or that when they begin to hear teachings on emptiness, they say that can't possibly be correct. You're going too far. You're falling into the extreme of, you know, annihilation, not us. So in this section, actually, I really liked His Holiness's comments at the very end of his section on this, page 44 of this, just one line. He says, so in the aftermath of negating intrinsic existence, which is what we just did in these first verses, what is crucial is to be able to maintain the validity of the world of conventional truth. So what we're going to see in these verses is that what they're having problems with is that because we refute inherent existence, they think that we're refuting conventional existence. This is people who are still holding those two to be equatable. It's equivalent to be inherently existent and existent. And when you negate inherent existence, you're negating existence. So this is really getting at what this whole section, these next verses that we're going to go into, is all about, and why we need to go in and refute each of these individually, kind of get these people to understand what we mean by the refutation of inherent existence. So let's start with actually just the first two lines of the sixth verse. Forms and so forth, although established by direct perceivers, are so by renown, not by a valid cognizer. Someone want to comment on that? Okay, so so let's go to the commentary. The very first thing that you have on page 223, that paragraph that begins where it says, opinion, the lack of inherent existence will contradict... Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. The lack of inherent existence will contradict the seeing by a direct perceiver of the five objects, form, and so forth. So what this is saying, again, is somebody saying, if you say that things lack inherent existence, you're denying what my five senses very clearly tell me exists. So my, you know, eyes that see fire and my nose that smells smoke and all these other things that arise, they arise and because things exist. And you're telling me that they don't inherently exist, negates their existence. And so it's directly contradicted by my valid cognition of these things. The fact that I can validly cognize fire and so on tells me that they do have inherent existence. The response, there's no contradiction. Forms and so forth, although established by a valid direct perceiver, have become valid with respect to mere conventionalities, which are established by renown. So he's going through, and again, just fleshing out what we mean by these two truths, conventional truth and ultimate truth. Mere conventionalities, one of the ways that they're established is in regard to what we would call is, you know, renown, worldly agreement, that we are going to call this mala, you know, that we're going to call that fire. These are what, you know, we're not negating that there's a direct valid cognition of fire or of these things, but they're established in the end by renown. It is not, he goes on to say, that the suchness of forms and so forth are established by that valid cognizer and have become valid with respect to it. So we're talking about two different cognitions. I mentioned this earlier in regard to the two truths. When we establish conventional truth, they're being established, as we said earlier, by that, you know, mundane mind. Where was it back in verse? Mundane beings see things, you know, and so on. Even back in verse 3, there was the common supports of the transitory being damaged by the yogi supports of the transitory. So conventional truth is established by the mind that seeks conventionalities only. This ordinary mind that is satisfied with mere conventional existence. It's not analyzing for how things exist ultimately. The mind that's analyzing for how things exist ultimately establishes their suchness. Their suchness is not established by an ordinary mind. If that were the case, if suchness was established by that mind, if emptiness was established by that mind, what would follow? We saw these consequences when we looked at the two truths. If they weren't one entity, or if they weren't different isolates. I think it was under if they weren't different isolates. If they were actually one isolate, then what would happen? When we saw the fire, we would see the suchness of the fire. That's what he's saying in this commentary here. He's saying, if that were the case, since even ordinary beings see suchness, it would absurdly follow that there's no need to generate superior's paths. And, you know, so we even saw that as a consequence as well under there. We have to recognize that we're valid in our ordinary minds with regard to one thing, but we're not valid with regard to the ultimate nature of phenomena. It's the mind that analyzes for that, and eventually the yogic mind that directly perceives that, that establishes suchness. We don't establish suchness just by looking at something. If we did, again, we would see it already. I'd get that this book is empty. There's no inherently existing book just by looking at book. There'd be no need to even practice the path. We'd all be liberated. It'd be wonderful, but it just doesn't exist that way. It goes on to say, and you should understand that the King of Meditative Stabilization Sutra refutes the sense consciousnesses in the continuum of ordinary beings to be valid cognizers with respect to suchness, saying, you know, the eye, the ear, and also the nose are not valid, da 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 da. The rest of the quote isn't given here. But basically, the Buddha himself said, you know, we're not talking about an ordinary being, sense consciousnesses, or even, you know, conceptual consciousness generally, that establishes emptiness or suchness. Just not the way that we establish conventional existence. So recall, though, that, you know, when we did study tenets, and we'll see this again in Lowrick, Awareness and Knowers, when we talked about mistaken consciousnesses, about the fact that we can have a consciousness that is not correct with regard to its appearing object, that has a mistaken understanding of them, and yet these can still be valid. So recall, again, that our conceptual mind, when I think about orange, the color orange, I'm getting a generic image of that color. That is not the real object. It's mistaken because I think it's the real object orange, but it's only an image of that orange color. When I see orange, I'm seeing the color directly. But that doesn't mean I can't have a valid cognition with regard to orange that's conceptual. So it's a similar type thing here. We're not denying that, sure, we're all mistakenly adhering to fire to exist inherently and all these other things. But that doesn't deny the ability for our conventional minds to still establish what conventionally exists. So we all say there's rain and there's fire and there's all these other phenomena that we've named. It doesn't deny their existence because we hold them to be inherently existent rain and inherently existent fire and so on. In the same way, you know, just kind of giving you a little bit of a relating it back to what we saw in our studies of tenets. Let's read the next two lines, C and D of verse 6. They are false, just like the unclean and so forth, that are renowned to be clean and so forth. So this is that next little paragraph, the objection and response. This is 6CD. If forms and so forth do not exist by way of their own character, why are they renowned? And if they are renowned, why are they false? So again, this is sort of an implicit objection. You know, somebody who's looking at the Prasangika point of view, and they're saying, you know, we admit that we can establish these conventionalities, but they're illusory, they're false. They don't really exist in the way that we, you know, adhere to them, nor in the way that they appear. So this person is basically objecting to that, you know, and saying, how can they be renowned then? And if they're renowned, you know, well, then why are they false? It's kind of like they're confused about what we're really establishing with this knower of conventionalities. The response is, things are false in the same way, and again, I have to maybe don't have to explain this anymore because I keep referring to it. This is Shantideva, a monk, teaching to an audience of monks. So this is the reason why he's using the example of an unclean female body and so forth that are renowned to be clean and so forth. The male body is just as unclean. You know, the body. The idea here, though, is that we have this idea. I mean, how many of you would say that after you take a shower that your body is clean? Everybody? Pretty much, yes. I mean, you know, it's a concept we have. And we also have even other concepts about the body. A body that we're strongly attracted to, we see as being very pure, not seeing the less pure aspects of it. You know, all the stuff that oozes out and all the pores and, you know. I always recall Gulliver's Travels when, you know, he shrinks down to Lilliputian. No, it was Lilliput. Lilliput was where they were small. It was the other one, yeah. Brobdingnagians or whatever, where he was really very small and they were quite large. And they would hold little Gulliver up to their nose, and he would see all the skin pores with all the dirt and stuff in them and everything, and, you know, found them to be really disgusting. You know, if we really saw the way that our bodies exist, I mean, have any of you taken one shower in your lifetime that was good enough to keep your body clean the whole lifetime? No. You know, so obviously our conception of clean isn't really correct. So it's just kind of pointing out in the same way, you know, while we hold things to have these false natures, the body to be cleaned or to be pure and so on, it's totally contradicted if we really analyze it. In the same way, you know, they're false. All phenomena are false. We can certainly see that there's other faults that we make. You know, we, as I mentioned earlier, we hold the impermanent to be permanent. And actually it's said that for the Four Noble Truths, each of these have four aspects. And for the first one, the truth of suffering, these all have to do with these four major misconceptions that we have. We hold the impermanent to be permanent. We hold the what is miserable to be happiness. We hold what is impure to be pure. And we hold what is empty to have a self. So these are the misconceptions that we have that influence, you know, our looking at the world around us, and we're not really seeing the reality of them either on in regard to the truth of their conventional existence, but certainly also not in regard to the truth of their ultimate existence. Okay. Let's go on to 7, the first three lines, A, B, C. For the sake of engaging mundane beings, the protector taught things. In thusness, they are not momentary. So now somebody's objecting. This is that next objection. If forms and so forth do not exist inherently, then this contradicts the teaching in the sutras that they are impermanent and so forth. So as I mentioned, when the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths, as well as many other occasions, he did speak about phenomena are impermanent and impure and what have you, and in the nature of suffering. All these things he gave from his wisdom observations on their conventional nature. And what this person is saying, this objector is saying, you know, if you deny their inherent existence, then you're also denying the wisdom of the Buddha that speaks to their impermanent nature or other aspects that the Buddha saw in his wisdom. So again, even when we get to the misconception, the one that I mentioned, seeing the miserable as happiness, we, you know, go about samsara and cyclic existence seeking happiness that really is, as we've seen in our studies, in the nature of suffering, in the nature of dissatisfaction. So we even have that mistaken conception. All these mistaken conceptions the Buddha rectified. So this person's having an objection saying, you know, if you deny the inherent existence of all these things, you deny all these other truths that the Buddha taught about them on a conventional basis. Why? Because, again, they're equating existence and inherent existence, and they're also looking at it from the standpoint of these are the tenets that they generally are adhering to. The teachings of the Four Noble Truths, as you recall from our studies of the tenet systems, is the primary teaching of the lower schools, the Hinayana schools. It's what they adhere to as definitive teachings of the Buddha. In Prasangika, they're interpretive. They're not definitive at all. The teachings of the Four Noble Truths are only a skillful means to get you to the second wheel turning, the teachings on the perfection of wisdom, which is what Shantideva is trying to get through to these rather thick-headed objectors. So he's saying, there is no contradiction. For the sake of engaging mundane beings in suchness gradually, the protector taught that things are impermanent. In suchness, things are not established as being momentary. They're not impermanent, inherently. Why? Because they're not established as being either one or many. This is, again, one of the reasonings that we're going to see in terms of emptiness. One or many is the same as the reasoning of being same or different. It basically is saying that things don't have any inherent existence as one, is, you know, they're one here in terms of mala, and the parts of the mala, are they one? Nor are they in many. You know, you don't see that there's even a, you know, some sort of difference in the perspective of this ultimate analyzer looking for the inherently existent mala. So we see that these reasonings when we are analyzing whatever we're analyzing, impermanence doesn't even inherently exist. The Buddha taught impermanence and taught the way that things exist conventionally as a means to lead them to an understanding of suchness, not as the final truth. This wasn't the final observation on reality. Yeah. Okay, maybe we can go just a couple more. I'm wanting to just get a little bit further. By the way, I did want to point out... let me go through this verse first. Let's just read the last line of 7 and the first line of 8. There is contradiction, even conventionally. There is not the fault in yogis' conventionalities. So this is, again, this objection, the next set. This is 7D, 8A, where it says, objection, this contradicts that the compounded are established as being impermanent, even conventionally, because things of the morning exist in the evening, and so on, are renowned as being permanent in the world. So what this person's going like back a step. They're saying, okay, well, you told me that, you know, your denying inherent existence doesn't deny the truth that the Buddha taught about things being impermanent. Well, but I'm going to go back and say, but conventionally we all agree that things are permanent, because the mala I had this morning and the mala that I have right now are the same, and therefore there's permanent mala, because, you know, the world agrees that there is this level of permanence. They don't really see subtle impermanence. So, you know, this, I don't know again why this person's necessarily going back further, but, you know, is trying to kind of, you know, say that there's still some contradiction in holding to the lack of inherent existence. The response from Shantideva says, although forms and so forth are renowned as permanent in the world, so although everyone thinks that this is the same mala that I had this morning, the same mala I had a week ago when I was using a mala to talk to you about emptiness, then it's a different mala because it's changing moment by moment. So he says, although we all think of it as permanent, there is not the fault that impermanence is not established by a valid cognizer, because impermanence and the like are established by the yogi's valid cognizer of conventionalities. So I guess, yeah, what's going on here is that based on the previous argument saying that in emptiness there is no impermanence, then that person's saying, well, then you're saying that impermanence in the face of a yogic direct perceiver doesn't exist. And the reality is it doesn't exist inherently. It still exists as what a yogic direct perception of impermanence understands. It's analyzing the conventional still and looking at how things exist conventionally. It's not analyzing for the ultimate. Again, we have to go back to that idea that there's different types of yogic direct perception. There's a direct perceiver that understands impermanence, and then there's another one that understands selflessness, emptiness. One is analyzing for the ultimate, the other is analyzing conventionalities to better understand how they exist. And this was a teaching of the Buddha to lead beings to an understanding of suchness, but it's not the final nature. So there are yogic direct perceivers, yogis' direct valid cognition of impermanence. That doesn't mean that impermanence inherently exists, and if we refute the inherent existence of impermanence, we're not refuting that yogic direct perceiver sees the impermanence of conventionalities. Is everybody kind of with me on that one? That's a hard one. No? Okay. Okay. So, we'll wrap this one up and then we'll go. So, what I was saying in the previous one is that in the end, the Buddha sure taught that this mala is impermanent, changing moment by moment, but that was a means to lead us to the direct realization of emptiness, and in suchness, there is no inherently existent impermanence. So now this person's saying, well, but then you're denying, you know, you're contradicting the fact that, you know, if you refute in that way, then we might as well adhere to what the world says. The world says that all things are permanent, that this is the same mala. You know, and that would then take precedence. The argument that Shantideva gives is that I'm not in any way refuting its impermanence. And in fact, you know, what the world sees as a permanent mala, not changing from morning to evening, is not correct. The valid cognition of a Buddha or any yogic direct perceiver that understands the impermanence of conventionalities clearly finds that there is no permanent mala. But that's untouched, in a sense, by the realization of suchness, and that it's not negated. We don't negate impermanence through the realization of suchness. We negate inherent existent impermanence. So there is no inherently existent impermanence. It's a very subtle point. Maybe I shouldn't belabor it. The next time around, we'll get it. So you might read His Holiness's book. One thing I did want to point out, those of you who are using Geshe Yeshe Topten for this, I found what appears to me, at least, to be a typographical error on page 263 in regard to this verse. It's kind of between the commentary on 6 and 7. Yeah, I guess it's actually the commentary on 7. The very bottom there, you'll see the very last line, there's a sentence that ends, truly exist. Let's go to the beginning of that sentence. It says, even if the Buddha has shown that they are impermanent and therefore momentary, this is only a method to lead ordinary beings toward the correct view of how all phenomena truly exist. Okay? How all phenomena exist in reality or something like that is okay. Truly exist is too close to what we're talking about, you know, true existence. So all phenomena do not truly exist. Or you could say toward the correct view of how all phenomena do not truly exist, and that would be correct. But as I see the sentence, it's a little confusing, just so you know, if you want to go to that. The bottom of page 263, you could change that last line, that first part of it, to say how all phenomena exist in reality or do not truly exist.
Yeah, because that term truly exist is used.
It's used to, yeah, that means inherently exists.
Inherently.
Yeah. I think what he was trying to say is how they exist in truth or in reality in terms of what their ultimate nature is, final nature is. Yeah. Okay. Any questions? Is everybody fried? It may take me longer to get through chapter 9 than I thought. I thought I was being really generous with time, but it's very pithy, and I think it also, although it helps to be going through it with this commentary, the commentary requires so much commentary that it almost elongates the amount of time that we're going to spend on each of these. But anyway, if you can keep up with the reading, certainly. If you do want to just particularly focus on this section, I'm pretty sure I'll finish this section next time through 15CD. And then hopefully I can even, or 15AB, and then hopefully I can even begin the next section. So, but I do appreciate everybody hanging in there and staying a little bit later. I apologize for keeping you here a little bit later on a school night. Let's go to just page 246 and just do this dedication from Shanti Davis text. I'll hand out the quiz in that for this section next time, I guess. Well, actually, I could hand them out after we dedicate. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled, with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds,
whose bodies are worn with toil,
be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Turn back a page on 244. We'll recite the long life prayers for His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, and Lama Zopa Rinpoche. But as usual, have strong conviction that you're also creating the causes for the good health and long life of all teachers with whom you have a special karmic connection, so that you may never be separated from them nor from their precious teachings in this lifetime and in all lifetimes until attaining the state of perfect, complete enlightenment. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjana's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers, honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. Lastly, we dedicate for peace in this world, in all worlds, within all beings. Thank you all very much. So let me go ahead and pass out. The quiz for this week has two questions on what we've covered already, and then the last one is actually on the very last verse of this section, so you won't maybe want to go that far. And again, they're already collated, so there's two pages, the quiz and the quiz answer. If any of you feel like you want to be looking at this commentary prior to class and want to know where, at least for this section, the verses are related to the commentary, I can go through that with you if you want to stay after for a minute or so. But I don't want everyone to have to do that. Just like we did tonight, kind of relating the verse to the individual paragraphs that are in that commentary, so that if you want to sit with that, with His Holiness's book, that then you can review Drakpa Gyaltsen's commentary before coming in as well. But I apologize that I couldn't have put it on your copy that you got, but I hadn't gone through and picked it all apart until, and I actually haven't gone through all of Chapter 9 to pick it all apart either, so I've got to figure out a way to communicate that all to you so that you can work with it. But so anyway, if there's some of you that want that, I can go through it really quickly. No, everyone's fried. Okay. Next time, I'll figure out a way to bring it in. And I don't know how to do this, but oh well.